not exactly comforting words this morning. From now on, five in one household will be divided, three against two, and two against three. Friends, you may have heard that the Republicans were in town this week. The summer meeting of the Republican National Committee just wrapped up in Boston. I'm not sure who was more astonished at the outcome of the convention planners that the Republicans would end up spending a summer week in Boston, the Republicans or Boston. But they were here, and now they've gone. Of course, there was a time when Boston was a very Republican town. It was, about 150 years ago, as the flag in front of the Union Club downtown will tell you. But things change and cities change, and today it seems sort of odd to imagine a Republican party in the city of Boston, especially after what happened to poor Mr. Romney. I mention this because, of course, the Republican Party has eagerly claimed for itself the identity of being the party of family values. It is predominantly among the ranks of the GOP, for example, that you will find the supporters of traditional marriage, which, I suppose, means marriage that excludes some people from admission and ends in divorce half of the time. Last month, an interesting article appeared in the online section of the Atlantic magazine on a sort of curious question. Why is it that the folks on the left of the political spectrum have a hard time speaking in the language of family values? And the author makes the interesting point that when the conversation is set in terms of the things that make for economic inequality, or on the other side, the things that make for improving the chances that folks who live in poverty will find a way to raise their standard of living, then the voices on the progressive side of the spectrum are very articulate, talking about factors like intact families, or the inculcation of values that place priority on education, or self-discipline and social cohesion. It's just hard for folks on the left to connect those ideas back to the church or to any religious tradition as the source of those values and these outcomes. And as the author goes on to suggest, perhaps one reason for that is an historic one. Because in our own political history, and pretty much the history of most of the Western world, the role of the political left has been to question tradition. So if that's your central principle, then it will be hard to sign up for the idea of a values-mediating institution like the church, because a part of what we're about, of course, is the handing down of a tradition that we have received to those who will come after us. By now you've probably figured out that whenever anyone in our debates over family values or social ethics or economic justice claims to have the authority to pronounce the Christian position on any of these issues, I break out in hives. I think something much closer to the essence of the Christian position on these or any issues was beautifully and succinctly stated by the new Pope on his flight back to Rome from Brazil in answering a question about gay priests in the Catholic Church. This was his answer. If they accept the Lord and have good will, who am I to judge them? An amazing statement. Amazing not least because Christians of whatever position or place on the spectrum of conscience seem to be united only in their swiftness to judgment on those with whom they disagree. That is not a practice or a reflex. That is the exclusive property of conservatives. We, too, have been quick to judge. When parishes holding views in the minority have taken steps to leave the church, we have been quick to judge and quicker to call the lawyers. The troubling teaching of Jesus in Luke's gospel this morning is a hard saying about the inevitability of conflict on matters of conscience. Any word from Jesus here on just what his doctrine might be, any specific rules on the matters that divide us so bitterly, all of that is profoundly absent. We have not been given specifics. Instead, we have been given guideposts. Love God and your neighbor as yourself. Remember that no one, no tribe, no class, no clan, no church has a monopoly on righteousness. We will always have a bad tendency to make in-groups and out-groups, and sometimes the people living most closely to God will be among the folks that you think of as in the wrong group. Mercy trumps judgment. All of us fall short of the glory of God and need saving, and on and on. All we get are general nudges like those. They seem to be designed with us in mind. The fact is that we do draw in-group and out-group boundaries. In fact, we're pretty much programmed to do that. We look for differences between ourselves and others as a way of telling us who we are. And the fact is that we do come to quick judgments about others, so quick that we are not aware of it. We draw conclusions about other people's character traits within seconds of meeting them, based on the structure of their face and the sound of their voice. Of course, we don't know anything about them yet, but those impressions are lasting, and they are evidence of our quickness to judge. It's almost as though to navigate the path of this life, God has given us stars, but no sextant. And so the conflicts of conscience that Jesus is speaking of today will happen exactly because the questions at issue are so important, press so hard on our weaknesses and frailties when it comes to being fair and compassionate and disciplined and honest. I have lost friends over matters like these, friends who considered themselves just as Christian as I regard myself. And maybe you have too. I have known that particular pain of finding yourself in disagreement so deep that it is disorienting with people I really care about and whom I know cared about me. For generations and generations, it was the distinguishing hallmark of Anglican Christianity, our kind of Christianity, that we could somehow manage to hold together in a single church people who disagreed fundamentally on fundamentals, on things like sacraments and the authority of the Bible and the importance of tradition. For generations, the Anglican Church was a place where people who believed in transubstantiation and people who thought that was all a bunch of magical nonsense could kneel next to each other in the pews and drink the same coffee at coffee hour. We are less that way today. We have unhappily followed the general drift of the rest of the culture around us toward deeper ideological divides. We are learning more and more the truth of what Jesus warned us about, family members being divided. It might just be that the best witness we can give to the Christian gospel in the world we find ourselves placed in is one in the opposite direction of that drift to extremes. It might just be that what we offer to the world is an example of what happens when a community of people begin from the position of recognizing their own frailties, their own limits, their own fallibility. Because when you start from there, the possibility is never far from your mind that your deepest convictions, no matter how dear they are to you, might just be wrong. And then you have to see the world and the other people in it a little differently. Rather than first wondering how they are different, rather than first wondering how they are wrong, you begin by wondering what it is you might have to learn from them. That is the sort of community, the sort of family that we try to build here. We know that we can be divided on matters of conscience. And over our history together, we have been. Jesus warned us that it would happen. But it happens not because some of us are wrong and others of us are right. It happens because all of us can only glimpse a small part of the whole truth of God. That is the family that we are a part of here. And the better we live out those family values here, the more we will be able to offer them to a society so torn and divided by conflicts of personality, posing as matters of principle. Amen.